Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
Good afternoon. Thank you very much for joining us on this hour of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. I'm Marcus Peter. We're going to open by speaking with our friend Doug Keck of EWTN. The University of Notre Dame has reversed changes to its list of staff values and has reinstated Catholic mission at the top of the list. It had, prior to that, removed it, as we talked about last week. I want to talk about the meaning of Catholic identity with Doug, because Doug, throughout his years, has also seen numerous institutions either completely jettison the Catholic mission or lose it and then reclaim it. And there tends to be a very predictable trajectory of what happens to the universities as a result of this. This is an important conversation, and it ought to aid parents especially in helping discern what future institutions we want our children to go to. Because gone are the days when we send our children somewhere simply because of the name recognition of the institution. If anything, the salvation of the souls of our students, our children, must be at the forefront of our minds. And so Doug and I will be having that conversation. We go on from there to speak with Constanza Miriano. 10 maintenance rules for marriage. Have you ever felt that everyone's marriage is perfect except yours? Constanza has... She joins us with advice for couples to not just survive their marriage, but thrive in it. It's a new book that she has penned, published by Sophia Institute Press, called Blessed is the Day We Got It Wrong. And it's received good reviews because with an engaging style, she delivers practical, profound, and sometimes hilarious exposition on how to thrive in marriage. And this advice just simply helps bring alive those inherent designs in marriage that God has put in that we ought to bring out, primarily by means of prayer, but also attentiveness, connection, and working with God's plan for marriage and the family as a covenant. And then finally, we speak with my friend, Dr. Michael Pakulik. Ruth Pakulik was a dynamic woman. She was a Harvard graduate, atheist turned Catholic, mother of seven. She was recognized for her joyful faith even in the midst of illness, and she died of cancer in 98 at the age of 41. Now, the Vatican has granted a nihil obstat, allowing her canonization course to advance to the diocesan phase. Her husband, Michael, joins us to share the wondrous heroic virtue of Ruth Pakulik and to see how we can learn lessons from her even to this day. All this after the headlines.
Thanks, Marcus. Good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Monday, November 24th. It's the feast of Saints Andrew Dunlop and his companions. Today's news is brought to you by Visiting Angels, providing loving care and assistance for seniors in need at visitingangels.com. About 50 of the more than 300 children abducted by gunmen at a private Catholic school in Nigeria Friday have escaped. The students who were taken in ranges from ages 10 to 18 years old. It's unclear how the escape occurred and where the remaining children and a dozen teachers who were also kidnapped are being held. This comes as President Trump has warned of possible U.S. military action in Nigeria over the killing of Christians by suspected Islamic terrorists. Speaking after Mass Sunday, Pope Leo said he felt, quote, deep sorrow over the situation and called for the safe return of all those in captivity. Pope Leo has issued an apostolic letter to commemorate the 1700th anniversary of the Council of Nicaea. Entitled The Unity of Faith, the letter was released in anticipation of Leo's visit to Turkey at the end of the week. The pontiff affirming the Catholic Church's commitment to the search for Christian unity and said, quote, the Nicene Creed can be the basis and reference point for this journey. New York Attorney General Letitia James and former FBI Director James Comey are having their federal cases tossed. A federal judge agreeing the appointment of prosecutor Lindsey Halligan as U.S. Attorney for the Eastern District was illegal. Comey was indicted for allegedly lying to Congress about the Trump-Russia investigation, while James was indicted for mortgage fraud. And officials at the Smithsonian National Zoo say a pregnant Asian elephant is expected to deliver her baby sometime this winter. It will mark the first time a baby elephant will be born at the zoo in 25 years. The news comes as a boost for the endangered species, as fewer than 50,000 Asian elephants are left in the world. From your Ave Maria Radio.net news desk, I'm Steve Clark.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. The University of Notre Dame has reversed changes to its list of staff values and has reinstated Catholic mission at the top of the list. We talk about the meaning of Catholic identity in these institutions with Doug Keck of EWTN. Doug, thank you for joining us once again. How are you?
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
As soon as I look forward to these times when you and I get to exchange ideas, and as soon as this thing happened with Notre Dame, I thought to myself, you've seen institutions do things like this in the past. Some of them have completely jettisoned their Catholic identity. I just want to give you the chance to speak to that now.
Well, exactly. I and this is my personal opinion, obviously. I'm not speaking for EWTN per se. I can say this, EWTN's Catholic, that I can tell you. And Mother Angelica made sure of that, I can tell you that. I think even, before getting to the Notre Dame thing, I think I've had some conversations even with Father Spitzer at times on the air and off the air. But, you know, we're very proud of all these Catholic institutions and universities and all the schools and all these things we have. But at the same time, you say to yourself, but how Catholic are they? Or are they only Catholic in a small C, this kind of, we're universally open to helping everybody. And is it really, has our Catholic outreach and education turned in just to be a social justice tool? Of helping, less fortunate people, which is a good thing. There's nothing bad about that at all. But it doesn't necessarily fulfill the idea that part of what you're advertising here, as you alluded to earlier, is that this is a Catholic education and people will be educated from a Catholic perspective, which is not the same as society. It is specific. And that's why, these hospitals that have all these wonderful Catholic names that do horrible, horrible non-Catholic things over and over again, I feel like more and more in the world we live in today, where the church used to have to fill in these voids, the government can do those things. Private business can do it. So maybe what we should do is consolidate our efforts into things that are actually Catholic, that are supported by Catholics, and that can be practiced and not worry about who we're taking money from or who's going to get offended being Catholic. And so if it's a Catholic charity, it really is supported by Catholics, and it has a Catholic ethos, and it does Catholic things. Whether it's a school, when you go to that Catholic school, it's Catholic. And if you're not a Catholic and you like to go there, that's fine, but it's going to be Catholic. And we're not spending all our time worried about the fact that we might make somebody feel bad. That's not the point of having that school. That's not why people are sending their children there. And the more they find out at times that it's not very Catholic, the more people find themselves saying, well, then I'm not going to spend my money to send my kid to a school which isn't Catholic. And, this reminds me of the university is the great old expression that Fulton Sheen said, where he recommended that you send your children to a secular university where they fight for their faith rather than a Catholic university where it's taken away from them.
You raise such a crucial point about I want to invite you to speak to the reasoning why you think, and I know this is speculation, but so many of them are doing exactly what you've just said. What's the motivation here?
Well, I think it's a combination. I think financially there's always issues. Mm-hmm. Let's face it, when you start taking money from somebody, from Caesar, Caesar has a say. And in addition to that, you're also your priorities. What is your priorities? Is your priorities like in this statement where they went from, you'd say, what's Notre Dame's no more priority? It should be a Catholic mission, a Catholic education. That's the number one priority. But in the mission statement that was originally changed, they, with this kind of updated version, you're dealing with some sort of community collaboration, excellence, and innovation. Are those all Catholic things? Well, they can be, but they can also not be Catholic things. And so the question is, what are your priorities? What is the most important thing? Is the most important thing for us, for universities, Notre Dame and other, be known as a wonderful Catholic university, or that it's very innovative and it has an excellent education and we're very collaborative and it's a wonderful community? Those are all good things, but it's Our Lady's School. It's in the name. So it should reflect her values. And, you know, you even had a while ago, they changed that, you know, Center for Virtue Ethics a while back, where there had been a Catholic center, mm-hmm. or I don't exactly remember the exact name, but that was the sense of it. And then we changed it to this more generic kind of thing, as if we're embarrassed of being Catholics, or that because it's Catholic, it's really not going to be as intellectual. I mean, that's kind of what we dealt with years ago. With the issues that came out of, you know, some of the changes in universities, where, in a sense, being Catholic was indicated that you were a bit of a Luddite and you really weren't on the cutting edge and open to all aspects of learning. And we've seen that opening ourselves up to some of that stuff doesn't work so well.
Inevitably, one thing has to give, and what we've seen happen is the Catholic identity gets shot. But yet we see more and more institutions insist on Catholic high schools rebrand. They're college prep. Mm-hmm. They're not Catholic or classical or whatever. And now universities, they are premier research institutions and not Catholic universities.
Right. Exactly. Well, it tells you their priorities. It used to be their priority was being Catholic. That's why Notre Dame was founded, what was it, in 1842 by that congregation of the Holy Cross, because they wanted a Catholic university that taught Catholic ethos and the Catholic faith to young Catholics and others who might want to go there. But that was the number one priority. If it was just higher education, they should have just paid to everybody go to Harvard. I mean, what do you need these schools for if they're not specifically Catholic? And you've got situations even, you know, with what's going on in Georgetown, which has always mm-hmm. been problematic. You know, we have these Jesuit schools out there that you wonder whether they're barely Catholic. So in those situations, you have people coming at who are running departments, if not the university themselves, virtually coming out with, virtually anti-Catholic statements. But they keep this, I think, patina of Catholicism mm-hmm. because it works well fundraising for the alumni.
Mm. And the other thing you raised earlier that I'd like to invite you to speak to is, as you mentioned, there seems to be, whenever the Catholic mission is just about getting jettisoned, there's an overt concentration on social justice. Can you please speak to that?
Well, I'm just an observer, but it seems to be that, you know, if the way we believe everything, it seems to be that, you know, the only message we have anymore is social justice now. Obviously, what does that mean? Obviously, people need to be treated fairly. We have to look out for the poor and the misbegotten and the widowers and the widows and the orphans and all of those things. But there is something more than just that. And I just think it works well because it's kind of a modus of agreement with the society. You know, it's a way of being kind of Christian and secular at the same time, because the reality is secular values in the United States right now are generically social justice Christian values in many ways. If you stay away from abortion and you stay away from contraception and you stay away from things like divorce and things like that or the gay issue, well, the other issues, they're, you know, as far as immigration concerns and feeding the poor and welcoming the stranger and many of those things, PBS is right on board with you.
This raises, therefore, that extra concern for parents who are discerning where to send their children for further education. There was a point where we had confidence in the big name institutions, mm-hmm. but now it's a legitimate moral conundrum.
Absolutely, and there are some organizations, the Newman Society, etc. You can go check out their listing of the most, let's say, quote unquote, Catholic colleges that are out there that at least give you the best shot. And it's interesting too, because it seems like Texas A&M and other places, many of these, and through Focus, many of the secular schools have a very strong Catholic presence now in that group that where people are bonding together through those organizations. And what are young people looking for? They're looking, in many cases, for a much more traditional Orthodox kind of faith, because they want the truth. They've seen what's been watered down and sold to people to make them feel better, and it doesn't. It makes them sicker, and people are looking for the truth, and the church has it. I don't know why we're so embarrassed sometimes about promoting it.
My guest has been Doug Keck of EWTN, and as Doug has been mentioning, we have to be bold about the centrality of our Catholic missions in institutions. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
Hello, I'm Marianne Kuharski with Pro-Life Across America. Did you know that a billboard can save a baby's life? When our billboards and radio ads are running, we receive hundreds of calls from those seeking pregnancy information and support. Every caller is connected to a local center offering free ultrasound and confidential counseling. Won't you join us in this life-saving effort? Donate today and help us do more. No gift is too small. That's prolifeacrossamerica.org.
This program brought to you in part by Ave Maria, Florida, a big kind of small town where golf carts take you everywhere and there's always something fun around the corner. Discover championship golf, resort-style amenities, and a town center full of shopping and dining. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at its heart, it's a community full of connection and charm. More than 25 model homes are available for viewing. More information can be found at avemaria.com. That's avemaria.com.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter, talking with Constanza Miriano. She's the author, most recently, of Marriage, Mistake or Miracle. Constanza, thank you for joining us. How are you?
I'm fine. I was trying to prepare my English. I hope I can do it.
Oh, no, well, I'm really glad to have you join us. The name of the book is Blessed is the Day We Got It Wrong. Constanza wrote this book and got it published by Sophia Institute Press. So, Constanza, I want to open by very simply saying it's easy to think everyone else has marriage figured out and that we are doing it wrong. Can you please just share based on your experiences?
Yes, I discovered, I'm sure that there's no such thing as a right marriage because men and women are so different that it is impossible to avoid to hurt each other, sometimes to disappoint each other. Chesterton used to say that men and women are different just like a fork and a knife. So you comprehend you are blessed when you discover your spouse's flaws are your chance to become holy. So to love just when the other person is lovable is not true love. If you love only those who love you, what credit is that to you, says Jesus. So we love your enemy is something we learn in family too. As John Paul II used to say, for many of us, family is the only chance to live the gospel, to put Jesus' words into practice, like give the other cheek and forgive 7 times 7. So there's no such thing as a right marriage.
And because of that, there's a lot of hope that Jesus wants us to be holy in our marriage. He wants us to be holy and happy in our family life. Just generally, can you please help us understand that better?
Yeah, I think that, first of all, to be holy and to be happy is the same thing. So I think that we get to a point that maybe sometimes we don't have to fix everything. I think, for instance, that talking is overrated, because my husband doesn't talk at all. So you get to a point that silence is the first answer, and we have to learn from Mary. So she was silent even when she did not understand. So you can discuss until exhaustion. So sometimes you have to pray and to ask Jesus to give you his own gaze on your spouse. So you have to ask him, please teach me to look at my husband or at my wife the way you look at him or at her. So sometimes we have to stop trying to change the other person, and maybe that is the moment that he or she begins changing, because he feels he's accepted, so he desires to be the way we want.
One thing you highlight throughout your book in various chapters, you go back to this constantly, is how central prayer has to be a part of the married life. And I know that sounds obvious, but please can you strongly speak to this?
Yeah, I think that prayer changes our hearts. So prayer allows us to behave, to act as if, as José María Escrivá used to say, to act as if is not hypocrisy, is to avoid surrendering to the crazy one at home, as Teresa d'Avila used to call the enemy we have inside because of the original sin. So the prayer can change everything in our marriage, everything, also in the intimate life. I think prayer is also a true aphrodisiac. St. Thomas Aquinas wrote that Adam and Eve, before the original sin, experimented a physical pleasure greater and more intense than the one human beings experiment after the fall of the sin. So God does not despise his pleasure. On the contrary, it's the way we give life through. So it's a gift. It's something he wants for us. So prayer can be important even in the intimacy.
I'm really glad you mentioned that, because many people listening right now sometimes have a hard time connecting the marital embrace and relations between bride and bridegroom with our life of holiness, a life of prayer. And yet the two are designed by God, and so they go beautifully hand in hand.
Yeah, I'm sure, because the church and we as Christians, we are not afraid of sex or happiness, the fullness of life. So we have to be sure that God is on our side also in every aspect of life.
And because of that, not just in terms of intimacy, but also just on a grander scale, the sufferings that married couples go through, even arguments, even issues pertaining to personality clashes, making decisions, God wants us to pray with each other through those things. Can you share more about that?
Yeah, I think that marriage is like it's the path of the conversion we have to go through, because women must fundamentally give up the desire for control, and men must decide to give life. That's the letter of St. Paul to the Ephesians. Mm-hmm. Is about talking about submission and being ready to die. So this is the two struggles men and women have to make toward the conversion, are two completely different struggles for men and women. That's why I wrote a Decalogue, one for women, one for men. And the first point for women is to be silent and to give up the desire for control. And men should learn to look at women, to listen, to look again if they have been to the hairdressers or if they have a new shirt. I don't know. So it's a struggle we have to do every day. Every day you have to begin. To begin again, but it's something you can't do just with the strength, just like when you train your abs, just struggling. So you have to ask for it, praying, because it's a grace. It's something not human, because even Jesus says that marriage is something like impossible in gospel. But there's nothing impossible to God, so it's a grace. It's something you can't really explain just with human state of mind.
Constanza, you bring up an extremely important point. We're running out of time, but like you mentioned, marriage is impossible without God's grace. Can you please finish off with that?
Yeah, I'm sure of it, and that's what Jesus says. So marriage is the miracle of being one flesh, starting from so distant position. So it's like a miracle. Maybe we'll be completely full just in heaven. I hope so.
Amen. My guest has been Constanza Mariano. She's the author of Blessed is the Day We Got It Wrong by Sophia Institute Press. This is a very pragmatic book, and it contains some very sound guidance for prayer and for building better marital habits with each other. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Hi, I'm Angie. Did you know a billboard can save a baby's life? It's true. You can make a difference this holiday by helping us spread the pro-life message to reach those who are struggling with an unplanned pregnancy. Our billboards and ads feature our 800 hotline for help, which connects people to pro-life centers nationwide that can assist with free medical help, baby supplies, and more. Won't you join us in this season of giving? Please make a gift today. Visit prolifeacrossamerica.org. That's prolifeacrossamerica.org.
When the need for senior care arises, home is where the heart is. Visiting Angels provides home care for mom or dad up to 24 hours per day, including personal care, meals, and light housework. You may select your professional caregiver with Visiting Angels. More information at visitingangels.com or at 877-374-LIVE. That's 877-374-LIVE. Visiting Angels, America's choice in senior home care.
Steve and Janet Ray here, announcing our pilgrimage to charming Ireland and its rich Catholic heritage. The shrines are nestled in the quaint Emerald Isle. Lovely people, marvelous food, sweeping vistas. Everyone's favorite is Mass at Our Lady of Knock and its Eucharistic apparition. We hope you can join us in August, along with our Irish chaplain, Father James Conlon.
To learn more about your Ave Maria Radio trip, find the Ave Maria Radio travel tab at avemariaradio.net.
You like pizza? Me too. And for that, we can thank our friend, Tom Monahan. First, he starts with $900 and opens one pizza shop. Then it's worldwide, thousands of shops. But all this was just a warm-up for his greatest achievement yet. He built a university.
God inspired Tom to build up generations of men and women who have a hunger to reach the world for Christ. This place is Ave Maria University.
Visit avemaria.edu to see what's next.
He was a pope, a saint, and a doctor of the church.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
Pope St. Gregory I the Great is one of only four popes honored as the Great. Among his many achievements was sending missionaries across Northern Europe, especially St. Augustine of Canterbury, who brought Christ to the people of England. In a pun, Pope Gregory called the English people angels. He died in 604.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Christ is the answer, with Father John Ricardo.
John chapter 8, verse 51.
Jesus is in a discussion with some of the leaders of the Jews. They're talking about Abraham. Abraham lived 1,500 years before the time of Jesus. So in the course of the discussion, Jesus says, "Truly, truly, I say to you, if anyone keeps my word, he will never see death." He says that often in the Gospels. "He who keeps my word or believes in me will never die." To which the Jews say, "Now we know you have a demon." And they say, "Abraham died, as did the prophets, all the patriarchs, the great men and women of the history of Israel. All these people died, and you say, if anyone keeps my word, he will never taste death? Are you greater than our father Abraham, who died? And the prophets, who died?" And Jesus says, "Your father Abraham rejoiced that he was to see my day. He saw it and was glad." To which the Jews say, "You are not yet 50 years old, and you've seen Abraham?" And Jesus answers, "Truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was, I am."
Strained or broken relationships are a given in most of our lives. Friends fall away, siblings drift apart, children sever ties with their parents, and despite our best efforts, these painful fissures are difficult to mend. Hi, I'm Dr. Ray. If you want to learn how to communicate better with the difficult people in your life and be a more easygoing, more forgiving person, check out my book, How to Get Along with Almost Everybody. Check it out. And all my other books on the store page at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Pisa. Ruth McCulloch was a dynamic woman, a Harvard graduate, atheist turned Catholic, mother of seven. She was recognized for her joyful faith even in the midst of illness, and she died of cancer in 98 at the age of 41. Now the Vatican has granted a nihil obstat, allowing her canonization, the cause of canonization, to advance to the diocesan phase. Her husband, Michael, who is a friend and no stranger to this program, joins us. Michael is a professor in the Bush School of Business at Catholic University of America. He lives in Maryland with his bride, Catherine, and is also a professor in the Bush School and their eighth children. He is the author of several books, including The Appalling Strangeness of the Mercy of God. Michael, thank you for joining us. How are you?
Hey, Marcus. So great to be with you this Thanksgiving week.
I am thankful for that as well. Pun completely intended. Now, I will say this is a side of your story that I think many people don't know, despite knowing you as an author and a professor. I want to give you the space here to just share your life and your experience with your bride, Ruth, and the Michael's story of Ruth McCulloch.
Well, I kind of have two lives and, you know, two families. Mm-hmm. One with Ruth, and we got married in college. Very early. I don't think I was 20. And we became Catholics a couple of years after that, and then started having kids. And we had kids pretty quickly, you know, the way they come out so quickly. And we had seven kids, and one of them died of crib death, and then Ruth died at age 41. And, you know, it's kind of a famous story now that on her deathbed, when I was professing my love for her and saying how much I didn't want to get married again, she recommended that I marry this person, Catherine Hardy. Eventually did kind of check it out on Ruth's say-so, and we fell in love, and we got married, and we have eight kids, and we've actually been married longer than Ruth and I were married. Catherine jokes, "I'm now the oldest woman you've ever been married to." So, and, you know, there are two waves. I speak of the first wave and the second wave of children. So a lot of people who know the second family actually don't even know the story of the first family. I regard the second family as kind of, like, I put it this way, almost paid for by the sacrifice of Ruth's death. I mean, the two families have melded together so seamlessly, and there's such unity. And, you know, the younger kids whom Ruth wanted to see raised by Catherine recall her mom. They hardly even remember Ruth. And, you know, it's just so much joy. My marriage to Catherine has been very, very, very strong, and I often explain it to her and to others this, when you've lost your wife, and then you understand everything that you had. I mean, you get married when you're a kid in college. You don't really understand, you know, the great blessing, really, of a Christian woman. And so, you know, there's this kind of very, very, very strong bond and attachment I have to Catherine because I lost my first wife. So it's kind of an interesting, complex picture. I mean, I wrote one book about Ruth, and you mentioned already, mm-hmm. Calling Strangers to the Mercy of God. I'm working on a spiritual autobiography, an intellectual under obedience, because Catherine has told me to write it. But I can't tell this whole story. This whole story is, I'm a philosopher. Catherine will have to tell this story. I mean, you need somebody who knows persons better, who knows
human persons better.
Psychology. Yeah, you need a woman. You need a woman to tell this story appropriately.
Even reading in The Appalling Strangeness of the Mercy of God, you talk about yourself that way, which is comical to me because you're such an astute writer to begin with. But I do want to therefore highlight that how you spoke about Ruth, complimenting your own shortcomings and vice versa, and therefore the heroic virtue this, what the world would consider this very simple woman, demonstrated.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's true. We're probably like, you know, horses that were in a common yoke or oxen, and we were both pulling at that. And, you know, I can say at some stages in our life, I was kind of leading the way. You know, I led the way in when we both became Catholic. We believed we needed assistance to get to daily mass. We wanted to go to daily mass. We wanted to pray every day, and we both believed we needed assistance. At that time, we were very closely associated with the Dominican chaplaincy of the University of Edinburgh, and they were saying, "Well, what about becoming a third order Dominican?" So that looked like, you know, maybe that's the right way to go. Or we had a friend who was in the Legion. And he was saying Regnum Christi was the way to go. And I discovered Opus Dei at Harvard, and which I thought was just fantastic. I thought it corresponded exactly to what we were looking for. Then I introduced her to Opus Dei. And then, so I was kind of leading the way there. On the other hand, going into the Catholic Church, she led the way. And at one point she said, I'm going to become a Catholic whether you are or not. And I thought, well, you can't do that. We've done everything step and step. By lockstep, mm-hmm. You can't say this. Of course, Christ has a much higher command and authority over us than personal relationships, even marriage. So, yeah, of course she can say that, and she should. She did say it, and I just said, "Well, then I better just join along." I had all kinds of foolish qualms about Mary, and I just said, "Well, forget them. I'm going to become a Catholic at the same." Well, it was really a reversion because. My parents never practiced, but I did receive the sacraments as a young kid. So, and I never practiced either, but I just said, well, forget this. I'm going to go ahead with her. She has good sense. I'm sure she's right about that.
You know, in your story, you also highlight how the both of you grew through, and you certainly make it sound like she seemed to lead some of the more pragmatic charges for questions of, say, contraception, abortion. If it's not too much, I want to ask if you could speak to that.
Well, contraception, we kind of both, when we were Protestants, became convinced that it was wrong, and we stopped using it. And this is through conversations with a really fine priest in the Archdiocese of New York. His name is Father Richard Gill. Maybe some people know him in Washington, D.C., because he used to be a legionary priest, and then he left the Legion in the Archdiocese of New York. But he was a high school friend of mine. And the three of us would get together. He, at that time, was research assistant to Father John Hardin at St. John's College in Long Island. And, of course, Father John Hardin is this great Jesuit dynamo. Mm-hmm. And Father Rich would get his latest books, and he wrote a book every month, it seemed, and pass them on to us. And we became very convinced of just the contraceptive mentality of it. It wasn't the argument about the vomitorium or anything like that. It was that it went along with a culture which we recognized was not Christian. And so we rejected it. And it also, you know, I suppose it's a little bit like this instruction, Donum Vitae, which then Cardinal Ratzinger oversaw in the CDF. This, you're inviting third-party technical persons into your marriage bed, and that seemed wrong to us. And so, you know, the whole thing, we just rejected it, and together, I think that was definitely together. Abortion was interesting because I was, I don't know, intuitively pro-life.
Mm-hmm.
So there was this, I tell the story in Appalling Strangeness that there was this time at, where we went to Harvard and, you know, we're having lunch in Courier House up in Harvard, and I was there with a philosophy friend who was a fundamentalist Christian from Louisiana, and we were, somehow abortion came up over lunch. And I won't go through the whole dialectic, but we went through about, you know, 10-step dialectic, and we refuted every position which Ruth took up. And you know, nobody's going to say on the spot that they changed your mind, but interiorly she said, well, they've actually refuted me. My position is untenable. And so at that time, she, so to speak, intellectually rejected abortion. But then when she became pregnant with the first child, then she realized what it was, and she came on fire for being pro-life.
My guest is Dr. Michael Pakulik. He is one of the professors of the Bush School of Business at the Catholic University of America. He's also the author of The Appalling Strangeness of the Mercy of God, The Story of Ruth Pakulik, and that's what we're talking about today. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Peter.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
In her diary, St. Faustina wrote, "If only I had a spiritual director from the beginning, I would not have wasted so many of God's graces. If even the saints needed spiritual guidance, how much more do we?" The nonprofit Revive app lets you meet virtually with certified spiritual companions, scheduling sessions at your convenience, helping you grow closer to Christ. Your first two sessions are free. Download the Revive app today. That's R-E-V-I-V, and then the number 3.
Feeling overwhelmed? Carrying burdens no one else sees? This Giving Tuesday, Ave Maria Radio wants to offer you a gift. On December the 2nd, we're dedicating a special Mass and lifting up the prayer intentions of our radio family. You've helped us proclaim the gospel. Now let us pray for you. Visit AveMariaRadio.net to share your prayer request. December the 2nd, let us lift each other up in hope.
St. Therese once told her sister Celine that when we trust ourselves and not God, our soul becomes barren and incapable of virtue. Her remedy? External works of charity. We all try to do it on our own sometimes without asking for God's help. At St. Paul Evangelization, we suggest sharing the gospel with someone who needs it. Check out streetevangelization.com to find a team near you where you can share the love of Jesus. If there isn't one in your area yet, perhaps God is calling you to start a team in your city. To learn more, visit streetevangelization.com.
60 Seconds with Father Mitch Pacwa.
The state has responsibility to orient things, but they can't take over the rights of the family, like in China, to have one child and that's it. It's a disaster over there. How many tens of millions of abortions have gone on? And one of the things that, as a result of that, is because of the preference to have boy children rather than girls, you have, for every 1,000 boys, there are 850 girls. This is a great imbalance. Same thing is going on in northern India. So this is where the government cannot take away the primary and inalienable responsibility of married couples and families. And they cannot employ methods which fail to respect the person and fundamental human rights. Beginning with the right to life, the government cannot force you to kill innocent human beings and still be a humanistic government. It's an evil government.
The people you know and trust are on EWTN.
Who belongs to the Catholic Church? According to the Catholic Catechism, all men and women are called to the Catholic unity of the people of God. In different ways, they belong or are ordered to belong. The Catholic faithful, other believers in Christ, and all mankind are called by God's grace to salvation. Those who in faith accept all the precepts, sacraments, and all the means of salvation given to the Church and possess the Spirit of Christ are fully incorporated into the society of the Church. One, however, who does not persevere in charity is not saved. He or she remains in the bosom of the church, in its body, but not in its heart. The church is joined in many ways to other faiths that call themselves Christian, even though they do not profess the Catholic faith in its entirety or have not preserved unity or communion under the successors of Peter. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Good afternoon and welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. I'm talking with Dr. Michael McCulloch. He is no stranger to this program. He is a professor in the Bush School of Business at the Catholic University of America, author of The Appalling Strangeness of the Mercy of God. We're talking about his late bride, Ruth McCulloch, who has gone to our Lord, and her cause for canonization may now proceed to the diocesan level, given that the Vatican has recently granted nihil obstat to the cause. So, Michael, you were just finishing up where Ruth and you landed on the abortion question. I know you wrapped up because of the music, but is there more you'd like to say to that?
Well, I think it was really having her first child and understanding what it meant to have your child within the womb and what an abortion would be that... led her from the simple, Newman calls it, as you know, notional ascent, from notional ascent to real ascent of the horror of abortion. And she, she's very idealistic person growing up. And, for example, the desegregation controversies were pretty live when she was still in high school. And she was, very idealistic about the, the unity of the human race. And so for her, that here was this new attack comparable to slavery, comparable to the Nazi program. And she thought, well, she didn't have the luxury of sitting it out and not opposing it. So she really did dedicate her life. Now, I want to say she in no way, stinted from being a great mom, great wife, great ordinary person, friend, parishioner. But, I have a spreadsheet of all her speaking engagements and so on, and which I've entitled Do Business Until I Come Back, which is what our Lord says in the parable in Luke. And, she was super, super, super busy. Like, you can't even imagine how many times she went out to parishes or to high schools or to youth groups, and every single opportunity she had, she took advantage of it.
You and her were not strangers to suffering, and that clearly overflowed into her speaking work, and you in your own work in speaking and ministry and writing. Can you please tell us about the both of you losing Thomas and what that did for your marriage?
Yeah, it's kind of funny. We lost a baby of SIDS, 7 weeks old, and that doesn't happen in our time. Of course, in earlier ages, if you had 10 kids, 5 of them might die in childhood. And so for us, it was kind of participation in this, you might want to say, the human condition for most of the human race. And I learned from her that blessed are those who mourn is meant to be a characteristic note of the Christian life. I think the church tries to teach us that in November, that someone we love who's passed, it's our vocation during this life to suffer out of love for that person. And she always did every day. She said, it's a wound, it never heals you. She said, find something daily that you can do, an act of piety to remember and pray to, because he was a baptized infant, he's a saint in heaven, pray to your infant son. And she would do this, but the pain never goes away. And one of her prayers, after she died, I found some prayers she had written down and never told anybody about. One of her prayers is that she would not have another child who died, because she thought she just couldn't even bear it, completely unbearable. She didn't think she had the strength to bear it again, second time.
Yeah. we've lost children to miscarriage, and so we can relate in a particular way, not in the exact same way.
Yeah.
I want to ask that you share, therefore, what the Opus Dei community did in helping you and Ruth through their time of mourning.
Yeah, the work was very strong, and also the parish. I want to say the pro-life community in Worcester is historically really strong and very stalwart. I mean, I think they viewed themselves as really going back to the abolitionist movement. Because they, you know, back in the 1860s, Worcester, it was kind of well known for chasing federal agents who were trying to enforce the Fugitive Slave Act, just kind of rounding them up and tossing them out of town. And that same kind of attitude found its way into the pro-life movement in the time we were in Worcester. It was a very, very strong community. A lot of Christian charity. Also when she was ill. So she was diagnosed 7 years before she passed away, 1991, then 1993. You have breast cancer. It's curable until it metastasizes. Once it metastasizes, then it's a death sentence because nobody ever recovers from it. Mm-hmm. So 1993, she discovered it metastasized. And, you know, there's so many treatments, and this is not even like part of the art. It's not even part of the articles which I've read about her life, but for 7 years, all kinds of chemotherapy, operations. They do mention the metal rod that was put in her leg. And she metastatic cancer the last year of her life is spreading throughout her body. And something really extraordinary about her was how she rose above all of that. I mean, suffering intensely, but trying to make things as normal as possible for her kids and fulfilling her responsibilities. And again, not at all letting up with the pro-life work. I think most of us would say, you know, okay, I'm sick. I'm going to lay back now and just take care of myself. And she never did that. You know, she loved mountain climbing and mountain climbing books. And there's a famous German mountain climber named, I think his name is Reinhard Meissner. And she used to read these stories of expeditions because I think it strengthened her because of what she had to face. And Meissner would say he'd be out there with his friend. I think his friend was Peter Hebler. And they'd be out there in the mountains, and, you know, maybe it'd be a snowstorm or blizzard or an ice storm or something like that. And they're supposed to climb some mountain. And Hebler would say, well, maybe it's not advisable to climb this mountain. And Meissner would say, we'll attempt it nonetheless. That was his famous formula. We'll attempt it nonetheless. And I think that was her attitude towards life. She had chemo. You're supposed to speak at some kind of debate or something. We'll attempt it nonetheless. You know, she laid up with some operation. You know, are you going to make lunches for the kids? We'll attempt it nonetheless. That was her attitude.
On the day she passed, you were blessed to be by her bedside after having rushed there. But the book also tells a story of a particular kind of miracle. It's almost as if everyone around in the town instinctively knew that she had passed beyond the veil.
Yeah, this is incredible. So you're recalling something which I haven't even spoken about for many years now. But I was teaching at Brown University at the time. I was a visiting professor. And she was in this period where it was called agonal breathing. You kind of, every breath you take is like a struggle. Mm-hmm. And I didn't know how long she would live. And doctors say she could live 2 weeks. So I continued doing my classes, and I did a class at Brown University. And I was delayed coming back, but when I got in the door, it was 3:33 in the afternoon, I remember that. Everybody's gathered by her bed. And so she's passing, my Bahari, she's passing. And I later spoke with a priest, and he said, oh, he's seen this many times, that people in their deathbeds, they somehow know, and they wait. And they wait for their beloved to come in the door. And give up their spirit, like our Lord. And she did that, and that was extraordinary. Also, the night before, I kept vigil at her bed, and just before I left in the morning, or before that, it's like 4:30 in the morning, she had been in a kind of coma for 2 days, and she came out of the coma, and she had clarity in her eyes, and she looked at me, and there's a look of, you know, this gaze of recognition, which, you know, the other person knows that you know that you see them, and she smiled, and there was such light in her eyes, and then it disappeared. But anyway, at that time, when she passed, nobody said anything, but people, this is before smartphones, but people throughout the whole city of Worcester started arriving at our house, all independently with a sense that they should go there. There's a woman who woke up in Boston with a dream saying, you must go see Ruth. She arrived in the morning. I think she may have arrived before Ruth passed, but in a dream, she was told, wake up and go see Ruth, and she did. And there had to be 40 or 50 people in our household that afternoon, that evening. And we all said the rosary together. Again, it was before smartphones. Nobody texted. Nobody said. Nobody made calls around. It was all spontaneous. It was very unusual. It was quite unusual.
All of this is testimony to the fact that this was a woman who walked with the Lord. Her life was given for the Lord. And so now at the declaration of the Neil Opstart and the moving forward of the cause of her canonization to the diocesan level, I want to ask that you share what this has been like as a journey for you, for your bride Catherine now, and for your family.
Well, to be honest, Marcus, it's been very difficult because it's painful. I would say that what happened in the last few weeks when the Neil Opstart came down, was Catherine likened it to kind of disturbing rocks at the bottom of the pond. There's a kind of wave of mourning. You know, mourning comes in waves, and the waves get separated over time, and they become not as strong. But a very strong wave of mourning hit me. I've actually been suffering severely these last few weeks from mourning.
Michael, I assure you we will all be praying for you. I've been talking with Dr. Michael Pakulluk, and we've been talking about Ruth Pakulluk and her cause of canonization moving forward. Thank you for joining us. I'm Marcus Peter.